Okay. Good morning and welcome, our students and special guests. Today we are excited and honored to host judges of the Minnesota Court of Appeals here at Open World Learning. In just a few minutes, three judges from the court will hear oral arguments in a real case presented by real attorneys. Special thanks to the judges and the attorneys who are presenting their arguments here today. We also like to give a huge shout out to Dave, Tim, Akira, and everyone else who has been helping to set everything up so that we can have this cool opportunity today.
As a quick reminder, the oral arguments are limited to 35 minutes long, but afterwards the judges will come up and introduce themselves and there'll be time for questions. Also, it's very important to be quiet, calm, and respectful here. The auditorium is now a courtroom. There's also video recording equipment that will be live streaming this event to other schools. And it is very sensitive to noise, so you really have to be quiet.
And now it is our pleasure to welcome the judges of the Minnesota Court of Appeals.
All right, Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bjorkman.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are very pleased to be convening court this morning at the Open World Learning Community. It is really our pleasure to be here. I also have the pleasure of letting a group of students know that the advocates appearing before us today are both certified law student and practitioners. And so it seems there is something appropriate about having students argue before this court in an audience of students. I will note that under the rules of practice that both of the certified law student practitioners are here being supervised by licensed attorneys. The first matter and only matter on the court to oral argument today is the state of Minnesota versus Khalid Adam or Adam. Counsel, I will remind you of the rules you probably already know, and that is you each have 15 minutes to present your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. It is important that you state your name and identify the party you are representing, as we are making audio recording of this argument. And that is the only recording that is permissible under our rules. And with that, Council for Appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Sam Beisman, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Khalid Adam, in this matter. We are here today because on the morning of June 20th, 2023, no fewer than six Minneapolis police officers awoke Mr. Adam by smashing his car window and wrestling him to the driver's seat before dragging Mr. Adam, panicked and screaming, across broken glass and into the street to arrest him. Our question at bottom is if this arrest of Mr. Adam was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States and the Minnesota State Constitution, and thereby if the district court erred in admitting a firearm recovered as a result of this arrest at trial that served the basis of Mr. Adams' charge of felony possession of a firearm for a previous conviction of a crime of violence. Before trial, the defense moved to suppress this firearm as the fruit of an illegal search.
And I want to just ask you, counsel, I understand the district court concluded that the warrantless arrest of your client was valid because there was probable cause to arrest him or to believe that he was in physical control of a motor vehicle while impaired or intoxicated, and that he possessed a pistol in a public place. That was what the district court concluded, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
With respect to the first offense, I understand the argument in the district court was centered around whether there was sufficient indicia of intoxication. There wasn't any dispute that he was in physical control of the vehicle, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then on the second issue, which is where I think it gets a little more thorny, as I read the argument presented to the district court, the issue there was whether your client actually had a firearm.
Well, Your Honor, at bottom, the question that the district court was seeking to answer was if there was probable cause sufficient to justify a warrantless arrest of Mr. Adam. And the argument that the defense counsel pursued belowhand turned on the credibility of the testifying officer's statements at trial.
Because there wasn't any evidence disputed and no argument advanced, as I see it in the district court, that the motor vehicle that was, it wasn't really parked as much as it was stopped, right? Idling, foot on the brake in this parking lot, whether that was a public place. I don't see that that was really litigated in the district court.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I would direct your attention to page 43 of the suppression transcript. In this matter, the state there did argue in their closing arguments that Mr. Adam was in a public place. And
was that disputed by your client at trial or in the district court?
In particular, the defense did not raise specific arguments as to if he was or was not in a public place. But nonetheless, we have adversarial argumentation and briefing on this issue because the state nonetheless argued that Mr. Adam was in a public place, and the court ultimately ruled only pages thereafter in the suppression hearing that Mr. Adam was sufficient indicia to suggest that there was probable cause for a DWI offense. Therefore, we have argumentation by the state and a ruling in the state's favor by the judge in this matter. This issue is properly preserved and before the court today for us to litigate. And furthermore, this court's review of these legal questions at suppression hearings include independently determining whether these sorts of laws were interpreted correctly. State versus Ten Yang is exactly on point here. Just as in that case, we are asking the question of if a district court made a proper legal determination of the question of a public place upon review. And accordingly, if the lower court was mistaken in their interpretation of what a public place is, there can be no probable cause based off of the officer's mistaken interpretation of this statute. To further continue and discussing the court's reasoning in Tang Yang and as it applies to this case, Ten Yang analyzed the question of if a person who is standing on their front yard with a pistol, arrested on probable cause of public possession of a pistol without a permit, was sufficiently a warrantless arrest based off of the fact that the officer made that determination of probable cause. And just as in this case, the issue of a public place in Minnesota Statute 624.714 Subdivision 1A was the focus of the appeal, a question that the court undertook de novo and eventually overturning the district court based off of what they determined was an erroneous analysis by the officer of if that person was in a public place. This case is indistinguishable from Mr. Adams. We are dealing with a situation where a police officer made a determination that someone was in a public place with a firearm and acted to arrest them without a warrant based off of probable cause of this offense alone.
My concern, and I don't disagree with, you make a good argument. My concern is that we don't have a record before us that we would be making a decision about public place without any findings along that line by the district court or really any focused testimony or other evidence on that point. I don't know, under the statute has a specific exemption for someone's, that a public place does not include someone's residence or the premises attached. We don't even know if Mr. Adam lived at the apartment building. So I'm just wondering how we make that decision as to whether the district court erred or not. On this record.
This is largely correct, Your Honor, but it is the obligation of the state to develop its record and prove its case at the district court. If it is this court's opinion that there is insufficient factual indicia in the record to make a determination here, it means the state failed the burden upon them to prove that the warrantless arrest of Mr. Adam was justified by an exception to the warrant requirement. If there, and you are correct that we have relatively few facts about the parking lot here, except that it is a private parking lot at the Little Bird apartment complex and the additional factual indicia that we can glean from the body camera footage. But again, it is not to the defense to make this argument. It is the burden of the state at district court. And
so, counsel, if I may, if I can just follow up or a bit on that.
So this is, you are seeking review of the order that was entered after your motion to suppress, right?
That's correct, Your
Honor. Okay. And in moving to suppress evidence, you correctly state that it is on the state to show that an exception to the warrant requirement applies. But at the motion to suppress stage, it falls to the defense to articulate the issue, right? Or suppression?
I don't think that's entirely true, Your Honor, because at bottom, the state has a burden to prosecute any individual who they choose to.
And that's, you're right in a very big picture sense. I'm not quibbling about that with you. But because we are, as Judge Berkman noted, and you seem to agree, we have just such an inadequate record on the facts related to whether this parking lot is a public place. And to some extent, that does fall to the nature of the motion to suppress that was raised, and that the evidence that would be offered in the hearing by the state would in part turn on the motion to suppress that was filed by the defense. The state's not required to anticipate every possible argument that the defense would make that a motion to suppress. So if our record is inadequate, we can decline to consider the issue and deem it forfeited. Is that what we should do here with the public place argument?
No, Your Honor, because at bottom, the argument here that the defense raised at the district court level and is properly preserved here is that the arrest of Mr. Adam is invalid under the Fourth Amendment because there was no probable cause to arrest him for either the permitless public possession of a pistol or the DWI offense. Those are the exact same issue with two sub-issues before this court today. It is the
counsel, we decide this matter on the DWI, and we found that there was probable cause just for the DWI. This court would need to address the public issue with the government.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I will note that if this court deems that there was probable cause to arrest Mr. Adam for the DWI offense, this would be the first Minnesota Court of Appeals case that determined that there was sufficient indicia to arrest someone for probable cause of a DWI offense when they were only found unconscious behind the wheel of an obliquely parked vehicle. If you review both the published...
Well, counsel, was it obliquely parked or was it merely... And in reviewing the video, it seems to me that the probable cause that the court indicated was Mr. Adam was unconscious or at least sleeping. The vehicle was running with his feet on the brake, and he was in the parking lot in a manner that he wasn't parked. It seems like he pulled in and he was blocking traffic. Why isn't that sufficient probable cause for a police officer, a reasonable police officer, to indicate that they believe that he was intoxicated?
Because probable cause needs to be particularized to the offense, Your Honor. And when we're talking about a DWI offense, what we're looking for is particularized indicia of intoxication. None of these circumstances are specific to an inference that Mr. Adam was consuming drugs or alcohol. Consider what police officers usually discover in cases where they determine a DWI is supported by probable cause. There was no smell of alcohol on Mr. Adam or in his car. There was no failure of a preliminary breath test or field sobriety.
But we have to take the circumstances as they exist in this case. Because the officer who initially responded to the report of your client sleeping in this area immediately saw a gun, or at least as the district court concluded, called for backup. This wasn't ever going to be a case where they would have probably had field sobriety tests and an opportunity to look for other indicia. I mean, don't we have to take facts as they exist here?
Yes, but as we apply them to the legal standard of probable cause for a DWI offense, Your Honor, we cannot allow these other circumstances of the case to substitute or make up for insufficient factual indicia of DWI for this offense. What our task is here today is to review the legal determinations of the district court below. And the choices and legal determinations that the district court below made was that there was probable cause for the DWI offense and that there was probable cause for this permitless possession of a pistol in a public place offense. It is not our position to speculate as to what other offenses there may or may not have been probable cause for. We are solely reviewing the legal determination that was made with the available facts for this DWI offense.
Are you contending that any of the district court's factual determinations are clearly erroneous?
No, Your Honor.
All right, so we have someone who was passed out at the wheel and doesn't wake up when numerous airplanes fly overhead. It's 7 in the morning, but it's June, so it's light out. Then we have a finding from the district court that a person in normal control of their faculties would not stop and park and leave it running that way, i.e. there's something about the operation of the motor vehicle before your client fell asleep or passed out. And I'm wondering, why isn't that, and why aren't the indicia, the factors we do have present in this case, why are they insufficient to support a probable cause determination?
Well, first, to specifically address your point about the unconsciousness of the driver, the officer in testimony himself pointed out that a response to a quote-unquote slumber could be someone who is either intoxicated or undergoing a medical emergency or unconsciousness. And the officer himself testified that the best way to determine whether someone is intoxicated or undergoing some other sort of medical emergency is to rouse them and interact with them. So the judge is correct that someone in that position might not be in control of their faculties, but we have no reason to believe that this is because of intoxication, rather than the fact that Mr. Adam might have been undergoing a stroke or some set of prophylactic shock related to diabetes. Because of that, we cannot simply say that a person unconscious alone is sufficient indicia of DWI. And why this in totality does not amount to probable cause of this offense, I think is elucidated by a comparison to the Gregorich case, an unpublished case from the Minnesota Court of Appeals, where the court found that the officers only met the lower reasonable suspicion standard, where the person in the case was found slumped over, idling in a bar parking lot and facing a snowbank with their door ajar. And probable cause, a higher standard, was only established after the investigating officer smelled alcohol and received an admission that they were drinking. For all of these reasons, we ask you to reverse the lower court.
Thank you, counsel. We will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for responding?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Kylie Munsey, here under the student practice rule with my supervising attorney, Nicholas Kimball. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this case. The court should affirm the district court's denial of the motion to suppress evidence and in turn affirm appellant's conviction because the district court did not err when it denied appellant's motion. Officers had multiple lawful grounds to perform a seizure of appellant, including the safety of appellant, the public, and officers on the scene, reasonable suspicion to conduct a Terry stop, and probable cause that appellant was committing a crime. The officers acted reasonably when they received a 911 call about a slumper or someone who seemed altered. When officers arrived, they found appellant unconscious behind the wheel of an idling car at 7 a.m. on a weekday. The vehicle was idling in a roundabout, blocking and preventing cars from exiting the area. The brake lights on the car were illuminated. Appellant had an open beverage in his left hand, and on top of all that, a firearm with an extended magazine under his right thigh on the driver's seat. During the approximately 15 minutes, multiple officers arrived in the area. They walked around the car. They made ample noise. You can hear airplanes going overhead on the body cam footage, and not once did the appellant show any signs of coherence. Not only that, but the area around the car had many people coming and going throughout, so the safety of this issue was really heightened by the presence of this firearm. You can hear officers talking, and they testified that the presence of the firearm really heightened the danger, and so their main concern was being able to detain appellant. They were worried he was going to wake up and start firing his gun, or wake up and start driving forward. There's kids going by on scooters at one point, you can see in the body cam footage, and so their main concern here was safety.
Appellant's argument with respect to the DWI probable cause, it focuses on the fact that this would be really one of, if not the first case in Minnesota where a court determines there's probable cause to arrest for being in physical control on a motor vehicle while impaired or intoxicated, where that we don't have the classic indicia, odor of alcohol, glassy eyes, watery eyes, admissions of drinking, things like that. And that's concerning because it potentially broadens an officer's ability to stop and conduct this sort of arrest. How do you respond to that argument? There just isn't enough here in terms of the DWI.
First of all, Your Honor, I would point the court to State v. Lee. And in that case, the court established that commonly known physical indicators of intoxication are not necessary to have probable cause of a DWI. It's about common sense and factual and practical consideration of an everyday life scenario, which this clearly was not. We also give officers deference when they find probable cause in scenarios like this because of their expertise and their training. And, excuse me, the officer during his testimony talked about how he sees cases like this that are DWI cases, and there was enough indicators for him that this was a DWI. It was not someone that's in an empty parking lot at night. It was 7 in the morning on a weekday blocking cars. And furthermore, we believe that there are 3 avenues that this court can affirm the district court ruling. There's probable cause. There's also reasonable suspicion for a Terry stop. There's also an emergency aid exception that was clearly needed considering the totality of the circumstances. And under the reasonable suspicion standard, if we do compare it with Breckenridge, which the defense cites in their brief, there was much more indicators here of the criminal activity than in Breckenridge.
I'm troubled with the notion that we should analyze this as an investigative Terry stop when the officers at the time made it very clear that Mr. Adams was under arrest. I mean, they broke the windshield, and I think you can hear on the body cam recording someone repeatedly saying, "You're under arrest, you're under arrest, you're under arrest." And that certainly was the intention to get him out of the car, away from the gun, and in custody. So I'm struggling with why we should look at this as a Terry stop. Can you help me with that?
Yeah. So while there are indicators that he might have been under arrest, that doesn't necessarily mean he was for sure under arrest. There's one officer who's saying it's not the one that's pulling him out of the car. One of the officers testified at trial that they were just trying to get
control. Oh, sorry. The officers broke the window, grabbed his arm, placed him in handcuffs, and says you're under arrest. What more of an analysis do we need to make to determine that this was an arrest and not an investigative stop?
Right. I realize this was jarring action by the officers, but we are saying that it was reasonable and it was really their only method of action because of the presence of the firearm. So even if this wasn't an arrest, it's an emergency aid exception. The doors were all locked. They couldn't open a door to grab his arms to make sure he didn't shoot. Breaking the window was really their only avenue. You can hear them on the body cam footage even talking around the car like, oh, I'm going to check this door if it's unlocked, this one. And they finally come to the conclusion they're going to have to break the window because that's really their only avenue into the car, that they can do it quickly enough and grab his arm to make sure he doesn't start shooting or start driving away. Does that answer
your question? So, counsel, the emergency aid exception, though, that isn't an exception that allows arrest, is it?
Right.
Okay. So we would have to conclude that this was not an arrest.
Correct.
In order to apply that exception. So what do you think is your strongest argument, counsel? Is it an exception under a Terry stop, or is it probable cause for arrest?
We think that this is, I mean, we don't think the district court erred. We think there is enough for probable cause, but we also think that there is enough for an investigatory stop under Terry. All the indicators for the officers showed that there was enough for a DWI or for having a firearm in a public place. As the court commented earlier, there's people coming and going in the area, and so we don't need proof beyond a reasonable doubt for a public place here. We just need enough for a probable cause, and this is definitely the case in this scenario.
So, counsel, if you would for a moment with me think about the next case, if this court upholds this arrest, finding that there was probable cause in this case, in the next case, does it allow officers to arrest any driver that is found sleeping behind the wheel?
Well, not just sleeping, this was the totality of the circumstances. It was clear he wasn't sleeping because there's people coming and going around the area. It's not the middle of the night. Again, it's the middle of a weekday. It's blocking cars. His foot is on the brake. The brake lights are illuminated. So officers think at first that the car isn't even in drive. He has an open bottle in his left hand. He's drooling for the whole 15 minutes, making noise. You can see officers are walking up to the windows too, and there's no coherence whatsoever. And so I would say in the totality of the circumstances, this makes sense if there is probable cause or reasonable suspicion that there is a DWI occurring.
I'm curious, what is the record evidence that this car was located in a public place?
Well, we have, it's in a a roundabout in front of multiple residential areas. And there's people coming and going. You can see people coming to their cars. There's no gates. There's no...
Do we know that in the record?
You can see it in the body cam footage. You see officers, they just drive right up to the area. You can see people coming and going. Like I said before, there's kids going by on those motorized scooters at one point. There's no guards in the area. You don't need a key. You don't need a code to get in. As we cited in our brief in State v. Hicks, this court found that the residential hallway of a building was a public place because
in that case, there was no statutory definition of public place like we have here. You've argued in your brief that the appellant forfeited the argument that this car was not in a public place. Can we review or that issue under plain error, or what is your argument?
Yes, we would point this court to under Martins, this issue is waived as a statutory interpretation argument was not brought up at the lower court, but under Martin, the court did review the statutory interpretation for plain error. And so that is available for this court. Even if the district court did make an error here, it's definitely not plain. It's not clear. It's not obvious. And the record is not established to support this new argument. Even the appellant's case, Thin Yang, does not solve the issue. That case dealt with the defendant's front yard, and this area is open to the public. We're not sure if it was the actual appellant's front yard. And even in Thin Yang, it says it leaves a lot of gaps open for what a public place is and what a public place isn't.
Is the argument in Yang raised in the district court the statutory issue, or was it raised for the first time on Kate?
In Thin Yang?
Yes.
I'm not sure if a statutory interpretation was part of that case.
Yeah. In the Martins case, we are dealing with evidentiary, the admission of evidence, right? And that being reviewed for plain error. Is that what we're doing here?
In Martin, they were talking about the language in the statute. They were talking about specifically, they didn't bring up the term child until the appeal. And that's when they brought in the statutory interpretation, which is similar to here. This wasn't brought up in the lower court. As has already been discussed, the defense counsel's strategy in lower court was to talk about the credibility of the officer, and the judge found the officer credible. No one brought up an objection to the public place error. Everyone agreed that it was a public place, and so that's why they found probable cause for that issue. So again, the officers acted reasonably when they received this call about a slumper who seemed altered. When they found appellant behind the wheel unconscious of an idling car at 7 a.m. on a weekday. The car was blocking other cars from leaving the area. And on top of all this, the safety issue really came into play when they found a firearm with an extended magazine under appellant's right thigh.
Respond to appellant's argument that what they observed in terms of the appellant's physical condition, right, could have been equally consistent with a medical emergency versus impairment while in physical control.
Well, usually in a medical emergency, someone's going to lose their faculties, and the fact that the officer testified, he saw him breathing normally, he's drooling, he's still holding this bottle that has liquid in it, so he's assuming if he's having a medical emergency, he would have dropped that. It wouldn't be the same situation. But even if this was a medical emergency, the officers would have acted the same because the doors are locked. He had a firearm. The firearm really heightens the scenario. If the firearm hadn't been there and this was a different case, sure, it would have made more sense to knock on the window, to open the door, but the doors were locked and there's the firearm under his thigh. So either way, the officers acted reasonably. This is what we want officers to do in this type of scenario. They're looking out for the safety of themselves, for appellant himself, for everyone in the area. They were trying to get control of the scene, secure the firearm. And so in the totality of the circumstances, we can see that they acted how we would want them to act in this kind of dangerous situation. If there are no more questions for me, I would just like to once again ask this court to affirm the district court's denial of the motion to suppress evidence and in turn affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you so much for your time.
For appellant, you have the last word.
In rebuttal, I would first like to start by clarifying the record on the Tang Yang case. Looking at that case, the case is not explicit as to if the issue was raised before, but it does not specify that the defense raised the issue of the statutory interpretation issue in lower court proceedings. All the Tang Yang case gives us is that the issue the defense raised was, quote, police officers lacked reasonable suspicion, end quote. However, this court routinely reveals issues of statutory interpretation for the first time on appeal.
Yeah, but those are typically cases where it goes to the sufficiency of the evidence to convict. And that's not our case, our scenario, is it?
Not exactly, Your Honor, but the principles are still the same. This court reviews legal questions de novo based off of the factual based off of the facts that we have in front of us. And the court is undergoing the same procedure in this sort of case, just as it did in Tang Yang. And speaking of those facts, Your Honor, we would like to specifically point out a couple of things that we believe the state is misrepresenting about the record. You cannot see any sort of gates or absence thereof in the body camera video. And additionally, the challenge originally here is to probable cause. The judge in the lower court ruled on page 52 of the suppression record that there was an arrest here, and in his words, there must be probable cause. Whatever argument that the state may make to the existence of reasonable suspicion are irrelevant to the point that they only meet that standard, because we need to meet the higher probable cause standard to justify this arrest here. And additionally,
counsel, if I don't mean to interrupt your train of thought here, but one of the arguments that that respondent's counsel made is that the officers acted reasonably under the circumstances, and particularly emphasizing the visibility of the weapon under the defendant repellent's thigh. So the officer could see the weapon, and they were concerned, given he was unconscious, that he would react in a startling way if they did anything other than the action that they took. So what do you think the officers should have done reasonably? Obviously, it's not what they did, so tell me what they should have done.
Well, I think first and foremost, if the officer's concern is the public safety, they should have cleared the area. They should have taken steps very easily to police officers to get the people who were around out of the area before interacting with Mr. Adam. And if we want a reaction that's going from the police officers, that's going to startle Mr. Adam and make him more likely to do something dangerous, well, that precise action is bursting through his window and grabbing him. The police officers had plenty of other options to try and rouse Mr. Adam, such as tapping on the window, trying to interact verbally with Mr. Adam through the car window, or if they were concerned about their exposure to the firearm, they could have tried blasting their sirens or using their squad car megaphones to try.
Wasn't the concern in that he would immediately reach for the weapon, endangering not only the officers trying to have that interaction, trying to rouse him, but potentially other people coming and going from this apartment?
Well, this, Your Honor, is why it might be important for the officers to take steps to clear the area. But additionally, what we need to balance here is the interests of officer safety with our Second Amendment rights and also the reasonable actions of police officers to detain individuals. We have to counterbalance both of these interests in considering the state's actions with Mr. Adam and the fact that we give officers of the state the authority to do things like detain people and seize them. And overall, it would be an incredibly reasonable balance of these interests to take these more measured steps rather than bursting through Mr. Adam's window, potentially provoking an interaction when immediately just waking up, someone might not know who's coming through your car window and then dragging you out of the car window and without taking any steps to clear the relevant area. And speaking of the reasonableness of these actions, the appellant, I'd like to point out the state has now conceded the argument that the medical emergency exception has never been used to justify an arrest and cannot be used to justify an arrest. Therefore, we can put it to bed that this would be a possible way to justify the probable cause required for the arrest of Mr. Adam. For all of these reasons, we ask this court to reverse Mr. Adam's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. The briefing was very helpful, as was your argument to the court this morning, and we really appreciate that. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the only matter on this court calendar today for oral argument. At this time, I will dismiss the lawyers and the three judges. We are going to go off stage out of the courtroom for a moment and take off our robes and come back and reconvene with the student audience to introduce ourselves and respond to some of your questions. Thank you.
All right.
I can't.